So Leslie has now put a burden upon me. First of all, this is very nice. Leslie's put a burden on me because I'm trying to make presidential comparisons to the framers of the Constitution for each of the people here.
Don't go there.
And
Eldridge Cherry.
But what she did do when she went down that route was remind me that my first appearance at an Academy event like this was with Lee Bollinger. We both had been named president of our universities the same month, and we'd been friends. Lee and I have been friends since 1979. We both clerked for the same judge, and then, of course, we were law school deans contemporaneously. And we were in a club uptown where the greatest 19th century president of NYU, Henry McCracken, had given a speech at the close of his presidency proposing that NYU and Columbia merge into one great university. And we were actually in the building where that speech had been given, and I remember pointing out the comparison between Lee and me on the one hand and Henry McCracken and the then president of Columbia at the time, because McCracken was an elegant, erudite scholar like Lee, and the president of Columbia was a shipbuilder from Brooklyn who had bought the Columbia presidency for $1 million. His name was Seth Lowe. He went on to become the mayor of New York. Lowe Library is named for him. And I told the Academy that night, as I will tell you tonight as you listen to this heavy Brooklyn accent, before you dismiss guys from Brooklyn, you should know that Seth Lowe invented the paid sabbatical. So I'm to set some predicate remarks here and then turn it over to three extraordinary people. And the format is they'll make some introductory remarks, and then we'll have a bit of a conversation where we probe each of them with questions, and then hopefully we'll have time left to open it for some questions from the floor as well in the tradition of the Academy. All questions having careful observance of the Academy's rule that they must be relatively short and they must end with a question mark. But let me just set context. It's easy to do. It's very easy for me to feel in this room a kind of special sacramental space. This is a room where I've spent many of the great moments and sad moments of my life. It's the great room in our law school. It's easy to channel the founder of NYU, Albert Gallatin. Gallatin was Jefferson and Madison's Secretary of Treasury. He became the ambassador to France, and he and Jeremy Bentham began to talk about the universities of their day. And in a letter from Gallatin to Bentham, Gallatin observing that the universities of their time, the great ones in the UK and here, were withdrawn and contemplative, wrote, "The time has come for a new paradigm, a new kind of university." And Gallatin said to Bentham, who of course, simultaneously with the founding of NYU, founded University College London, "The time has come for universities that are," and here are his words, quote, "in and of the city," close quote, "in and of the city." And there's a way in which when I read those words, and I read them for the first time in 2001 after I'd been named, and I'd been named about 4 months before 9/11. So it was just before that that critical threshold in the story of our city and our country and the world in a way. When I read those words, all of a sudden, NYU made sense to me in a way it hadn't up until that point. You know, being in the law school, in this room, in this building, was like being in a parish. It was the place, like the bar in Cheers, where everybody knew your name, and everybody knew everybody else's name. But NYU, even viewed from here, seemed rather abstract to me and cacophonous and complex. But once I read that phrase, I came to understand that what Gallatin and his successors, down to the great John Bradamus, who's in the first row and really represented another pivot point in the history of this university when he came here in 1981. What they had done was they had created a university literally with no gates, most of whose buildings were not next to each other. Most of our buildings, when you get out of the square, and there are over 100 that are not in the square, you walk out of them and you look to your left, to your right, and across the street, and you can't see an NYU building. You have to walk a block or two, and then you see an NYU building. And I began to realize from Gallatin's phrase that there was a strength to that, to being in and of the city in this radical way, to be ecosystematic with it, to in a way declare it as completely symbiotic with you. And that got me thinking more about the city. Of course, 9/11 got all of us thinking about the city in a very different way, and seeing, for some of us at least, seeing the city as having a special role to play in the world, this particular city as a miniaturization of the world in the way no other city is. But flash forward then to February of 2005, and I'd been talking informally to folks around town about the relationship of universities and cities. And Mike Bloomberg, and this was very much, I started today, it shows you the university in the city. I started today at a breakfast, it wasn't an intimate breakfast, it wasn't me and the mayor, it was me, probably 400 other people and the mayor. I mean, he was up there, I think he saw me, I kept trying to say. The mayor gave a significant talk about the role of thought and innovation in the future of cities and nations. And I'd like to think that a little of that came from the fact that in February 2005, interestingly, just 7 months before his race for his second term as mayor, he asked if I would run a retreat, a two-day retreat for his commissioners, in which I would visualize what was necessary to make New York City great in 2050. 2050, not 15, 2050. It's really interesting that he was thinking that far out, even as his election came close. It was very frustrating for his commissioners, who said, you know, it's not gonna make any difference what we think if we're not reelected, Mr. Mayor. And he said, no, keep your eye on it. And as I began to talk to my colleagues here at NYU, because really all I am is their mouthpiece, and about what had made the city great and what would make the city great or would be necessary to make the city great 50 years later, they taught me this acronym, FIRE, as what made cities great in the 20th century. FIRE, at least that's what made New York City great: finance, insurance, real estate. FIRE. And I had a concept about what was needed. I knew that FIRE would be necessary in 2050, but not sufficient, that something else was happening. I could feel it happening as we tried to attract talent to the university. And what talent wants is, it wants other talent. And not necessarily talent, again, necessary to have talent in its own area, the cluster, the critical mass, But you know, a talented genomicist wants to be able to go to a good play and hear a good symphony and have a good conversation over dinner with a philosopher, and wants that same for his or her family. So I had come up with this concept. I was in the car driving over to Staten Island for this two-day retreat. I didn't yet have the name, and thankfully, as in most good things in my life, this good thing, this label, and I'm going to make a confession to the Academy, I hope my membership isn't revoked, because people think that this label came from the Frost poem or the Valhalla myth, because, you know, I'm an intellectual after all. The fact of the matter is, I had the concept, was struggling for an acronym to go with FIRE, and my wife was the president of the Charles Revson Foundation, and I knew through Lisa that Revson's biography, named for his great lipstick, was Fire and Ice, which is, by the way, coming back on the market. And I went over and I said, yeah, what's going to be needed in 2050 is not just finance, insurance, real estate, fire, but also it's going to have to be supplemented by ICE, the intellectual, the cultural, the educational. And then I discovered Daniel Patrick Moynihan's great phrase that if you wanted to build a great city, you should create two great universities and wait 200 years. Now today, of course, things happen much more quickly, but that I stand today by that basic fire and ice metaphor. And there's a way in which, I joke with Lee, I say, you know, if New York goes south, you can go to South America. But NYU's got to stay here because we got New York in our name, not Columbia. But the fact of the matter is, you know, in this time when all kinds of industries move, the universities stay and they anchor. And we depend on our cities and they depend on us in a deep way. So with that as predicate, I get to introduce, you know, these three people and their biographies, I've been told, are in your paper. So I'm going to give a kind of general introduction to just say something that I mean from the bottom of my heart. And I always do things in fours. So I'm not doing this simply because it allows me to tell every other president that I meet that he or she was the fourth. But I will say this, and I mean it, and my colleagues that are here in the room know, because I speak about these people constantly. If you asked me to name my four heroes among the leaders of higher education in this country, these three people would be three of the four. Now, that's in part because Leslie asked me who I'd like to have here tonight, and I was self-indulgent. But these are three of the wisest, most extraordinary, most virtuous, and most visionary people that I know. And when we get together at the AAU each year, which of course Bob leads, when we get together at the AAU each year, these are three of the people that I always try to make sure to get a chance to hug, and if I can, to entice them to a cup of coffee so I can learn more from them. Each of the three of them in different ways has helped me be better both as a person in the world and as a president, and I'm just delighted to welcome all of you. And with that, I'll turn it over to a person to whom NYU gave an honorary doctorate last year because we admire him so much, and that is our leader at the AAU, Bob Beardall, who, of course, you know, had two presidencies before that. Bob.